Okay, so thank you, Céline, and thank you, Céline and Luca, for, of course, all the work and for inviting us. Thank you to the Perimeter Institute for the great hospitality. It was a pleasure to be here, as always. So thanks very much, Laurent, for having us. Okay, I want to talk about geometric actions and, in particular, how they can be useful for gravity in three or in four dimensions. So I will start with giving some general comments on effective actions for Goldstone bosons, if you want, or so things which are probably well known, but at least maybe not to everybody, so I will try to recall them for the community here. Then I will switch to geometric actions, and I will do an exercise which will probably make Simone happy, even though Michele of course everything is well known, but it's always nice to phrase these things in the language that you understand best. So this is kind of an exercise, but I found it very instructive for myself, so maybe it's going to be useful for you as well. And then I will apply these considerations to gravity. So this was based on work done we did a couple of years ago with Hernan and Patricio. And we have recently gone back to this work because we were trying to write it out explicitly in the case of BMS4, and this is work done with Kevin and Romain. Very good. So the problem is, suppose that you have a group, a Lie group of symmetries. You know they are the symmetries of your theory, and you do not know necessarily the fundamental theory. So the problem is, can you write an action principle whose global symmetries is the group you are interested in, and so that the neutral charges of the symmetry group are really arise as neutral charges of this theory, if you will. And of course, if you can write an action principle, you can quantize the theory either canonically or by path integral methods, and you have at least an avenue to say something about quantum things. So you want these neutral charges to be realized dynamically, or the associated current algebras. And the standard thing to write down is to write this this kind of action. So you take the trace of the, in this case, the right invariant Maurer-Karthoff form, and you write trace d mu g, g minus 1 squared, if you want. So this would be a model in four-dimensional Minkowski space that has built-in Poincaré invariance plus the global symmetry group that you are interested in. So it has, so in that sense, it already realizes what you want. And there is, of course, an easier version of that, which is not doing it with the base space, which is Minkowski space, but to take as the base space just a line and to take a particle model. So you write this right invariant Maurer-Karthoff form and you write down this action principle. So it's absolutely obvious that this has global right invariance. So it has the symmetry group that you want to study. Because if you translate your group element on the right by a constant element h of r, so which doesn't depend on the base space or on t, of course you just write the right invariant Maurer-Karthoff form, and you realize that you cancel the group element in between, and the global symmetry is manifest. So this is, of course, very well known. But what I found useful lately was to, because suppose you want to study the Hamiltonian formalism of that, or to do explicit computations on that, which involve, if you want, coordinates. Because these group elements, usually they are constraints, they are matrices which are not free matrices. So sometimes it's easier to express everything in terms of coordinates on the group. So in the language of Andreas' example, so in Andreas' example, favorite example of SO3, you would take Euler angles. G mu are the Euler angles, and you want to write everything in terms of these Euler angles, if you want. You want to be more fancy, you say that since these are arbitrary coordinates on the group, you can think of this as a kind of abstract index notation for this approach. So if you then write, you take your favorite textbook on Lie groups and Lie algebras. In my case, this happens to be the chapter in Choquet-Bruyat, where he explains all these things. So for instance, you know that the generators of right-left translations are left and right invariant vector fields, and these vector fields are going to be the main objects of your theory. So you have these vector fields, which are encoded in these matrices. You have as many as the dimension of the Lie algebra, and everything on the fact, all the information on your Lie group is contained in the fact that these matrices, the commutation relation of these vector fields close with the structure constants of the Lie algebra. If you take the left invariant ones, or if you take the right invariant ones, you get minus the Lie algebra constants, and the L's and the R's, they commute because left and right translations commute. So that's the coordinate expression, if you want, of your Lie algebra information. And then the left and right Maurer-Carton forms that you have, you write them down. You can then write them down very explicitly, so you know they are one forms with value in the Lie algebra, and they are completely determined by these inverse matrices, L minus one and R minus one. And the adjoint representation, of course, in this context, it just becomes, so it's right multiplication by G minus one, left multiplication by G. So in terms of these matrices, it's just represented by R minus one times L, so the matrix that you get. And then you can write down explicitly your action. It looks a bit more like actions you are used to. So you see that this action, which involved this right invariant Maurer-Carton forms, really becomes a quadratic action in the velocities like this, with a metric, which is in fact, in this case, the extension of the Killing metric at the origin as a right invariant metric on the whole group, if you want. So you have this metric G mu nu of G. So that's your action principle, if you want. Of course, you look at the global symmetries as explained. They are generated by the left invariant vector fields. So for each Lie algebra element, the infinitesimal symmetry generator is like that. You compute the neutral charge according the standard, according to the standard formula that you know, and you find that the neutral charge is just a contraction of the d over dt g minus one with the adjoint going on x. Then, of course, it's completely clear what the equations of motion of this model are. You can ask your students in the classical mechanics course, and the equations of motion following from varying this are, of course, the geodesic flow equation associated to this metric here. So the gammas here are associated to g mu nu of g. So that's completely standard, of course, but that's the model that you are writing, and that's the model which have your symmetries implemented. Then we saw in Andreas' lectures the first day, we saw that there is this theorem, which is probably due to Arnold, which says that this dynamics, this geodesic flow, is exactly the same thing than this dynamical equation, so this dynamical equation here, in the dual of the Lie algebra. Andrea didn't give us the proof of that. The proof is absolutely well-known, completely standard, but for those who don't know it, if you do have to do the proof yourself, the only thing you have to do is to do the Hamiltonian analysis of this action. If you do the Hamiltonian analysis of this action, the proof comes out automatically. Let me maybe run you through it, how it goes. So you have this action which is quadratic in velocities. You introduce canonical momenta. In this case, the canonical momenta, of course, are just the dl over dg dot. You write down what this gives. So you have your phase space with your Darboux coordinates, if you want, here. And then while going through the computation, it already appears evident that there's one combination which is better than the piece, which is the piece multiplied by these matrices which characterize the right invariant vector fields. So these matrices are here. Because then one of the things is that all your formulas become compact. So you invert, in this case, the Legendre transform is, you can do it. There's no gauge invariances to worry about. and you get you just pursue with the Hamiltonian analysis. So in terms of this non-Darboux coordinates, if you use the pi's instead of the p's, what is very very nice, of course, is that the Poisson bracket of this pi's is just the Kirillov Constant Souriau bracket that you have on the dual of the Lie algebra. So the pi's are really coordinates on G star, if you want. And the bracket comes out completely naturally in this kind of construction. And in this non-Darboux coordinate, so you have pi's with pi's, which is no longer zero, which is Kirillov Constant Souriau. You have G with G's, which is zero, and G with P's, which is no longer delta, but it's this right this right matrix here, if you want. The first order action in Hamiltonian form is, of course, the only thing that you still have to compute is the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is the simplest things in the pi's that you can imagine. It's pi squared with the inverse Killing metric, if you go through the construction. And then you write down the Hamiltonian equations associated to that. So there is the evolution equations for the coordinates, so G dot Poisson bracket with H. This just is this equation. Of course, this is not a new dynamical equation. It's just equivalent, as usual in the Hamiltonian formalism, to the definition of the momentum. So the only thing that is left, which is non-trivial, is the equation for the pi's, and that's this equation that we saw that we saw up here, just written in a mathematical language, of course. Okay. So, so that's this Arnold theorem. So if you know Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics, there's almost nothing to do. You have the Hamiltonian version of the Noether charges, where in this case, instead of having the right invariant Maurer-Carton form contracted with the velocity, you just have pi instead in the Noether charge. And of course, what you win, if you want, you have a canonical generator for your symmetry transformation. So there are, of course, more general Hamiltonians than one can study than this Hamiltonian, which is always associated to the Killing metric. So in this case, one talks about inertia operators. And so you have a more general application from G to G star, which is invertible. And with the right choice of these inertia operators, for instance, you are describing in Andrea's favorite example, you are describing, for instance, the Euler top. The other interesting remark about this kind of Hamiltonian systems is that it's actually B-Hamiltonian and integrable systems. The way to see this is to see that there is a second compatible Hamiltonian structure, which is exactly the same KKS bracket that you have seen before, except that, you know, instead of having on the right-hand side the pi's, you put a fixed coadjoint vector there. And then you can check that these two Hamiltonian structures are compatible and that you have a B-Hamiltonian system which is integrable. So there are experts not far from you here at the University of Toronto which have written this very nice book here. We saw that in Laurent's talk, so Kazin, he had one of these references on that. They have a whole book, very readable, very short, kind of in the Arnold school language, where they explain exactly what I have given you here. And for instance, Laurent's favorite example, S diff with the fluid mechanics, is treated in some detail. Okay, so this is fairly well known. Let me give you another example of this kind of systems, which is a bit more interesting because it has gauge invariance, and that's also something that we are going to need a bit later on. So if you look at the bosonic sector of n is equal to 4d is equal to 4 supergravity, so you keep only the scalars. This is a theory which is an SL2R over SO2 symmetric space. So, and The reason why I want to show you this gauged kind of sigma models is that in this case, again, if you do the construction right, the global symmetry is manifest. But if you write it down in the coordinates, it's no longer completely, it's no longer clear where this symmetry comes from. But if you write it down as this kind of sigma models, then the symmetry is completely transparent. And since we will have one part of this, let me run you through the example. So you're looking at this SL2A mod SO2. The Lie algebra is, of course, very well known, SL2A. If you take your Euler angles in that case, you can parameterize them. So here is the SO2 part that you parameterize. The psi is the g mu for the SO2. Here is the phi, which goes with the h, and then with the upper triangular is the chi. So this is called in the literature the dilaton, and this is called the axion, as you will see. So these are your coordinates, and if you only parameterize this symmetric space, you only keep the axion and the dilaton as coordinates. And then you write almost the same object, this right invariant one form that we have seen, this p mu, except that you use this Cartan involution to write this combination here. So it's d mu gg minus 1, but you also put 1 half with the transpose, if you want. And then you study how g changes when you do a left multiplication by a local SO2 and a right multiplication by a global SL2R. And the important thing is that this p mu, under this gauge transformation here, transforms in the adjoint. It's k minus 1. And then if you write down trace of p mu in that case, because this transforms like that, you see that the k drops out of the equation and the the SO2 is no longer in the theory. So it's pure gauge, if you want. Okay? And the theory is only a theory for the axion and the dilaton. And, but you know by construction that it has SL2R global invariant. And when you look at how this SL2R invariance really appears, and if somebody would give you the action and you don't know that this is hyperbolic space or something like that, if somebody gives you just this action and they tell you that it has these symmetries, which you now can work out, they are kind of hard to find if you didn't know the construction. So they are kind of hidden, and it's the theory of nonlinear realizations, if you want. So that's another example of this kind of construction where you have the symmetries by just by construction. And once you are done, it's no longer so obvious why you had them. But from the beginning, of course, they are transparent. And of course, there is this thing that you have to do. One of the symmetries, which is the symmetry associated to E minus, is complicated because if you work in this Borel gauge, you have to do a compensating gauge transformation to bring you back to the gauge, if you very good. What are geometric actions? So everything that I've shown you so far works very well in case you have a Killing metric. Suppose you don't have a Killing metric, can you still write down action principles? That's the question. And because here you see that we, with the Killing metric, you get naturally quadratic actions, which invertible kinetic terms, and so on. But if you have, if you don't have that, there is, of course, you still can build an inner product. And the way to build the inner product and to write an action is just to use a coadjoint vector to do the construction. So you don't need the trace. You just use a fixed coadjoint vector, B0. And you write still down a kinetic term, which has the right symmetry. So B0, fixed coadjoint vector, times the right invariant Maurer-Cartan form. And if you want Hamiltonians, you can put Hamiltonians in your theory, which do not destroy your right invariant symmetries. So you can put this kind of Hamiltonians, which are the same than the Noether charges we've seen before, but you put a fixed B0 here. So if you want your whole, so it is still true that the whole Lie algebra or the right translations are symmetries, but you have to give the generators of the right translations have to have explicit time dependence, and this explicit time dependence is fixed by the Hamiltonian that you are choosing. So symmetry is maintained, but you get time dependence of these objects here. And so you have a geometric action for any group which has the right symmetries, and then in principle you can use that to do a path integral quantization. But as Andrea also told us already, this will not work immediately like that because you have still gauge invariances in this system. So if you try to path integrate, to do the path integral quantization, you get the standard infinities because you have gauge symmetry. So the point is, as we heard, that this symplectic, this potential here is pre-symplectic and not symplectic because it has zero directions. It has gauge invariances. And Andrea told us what these gauge invariances are. They are, in fact, related to the little group of B0, right? So the same one-line computation that he showed us tells you that if you take a left multiplication by an arbitrary, by an epsilon which can depend arbitrarily on time, this is gauge symmetries of these actions provided that it belongs to the little algebra of B0, so to the infinitesimal transformations that keep B0 invariant. Okay, so that's how you gauge transformations. They are very easy to find. It's again a one-line computation. What is a bit harder to prove, but is again very well known, but it still takes a bit of work to prove in whatever formulation you're using, is are these all the gauge transformations? Because if you don't know that they are all the gauge transformations, you still cannot do your BV or BFV in order to fix the gauge because you still would have redundancies. So something that you should study is prove that, of course it's known, but prove that these are all the gauge symmetries. There is a second thing that you can wonder about, which is this gives you many models to study. So. Of course, you have a fixed Hamiltonian. I will tell you later what is the motivation to choose some Hamiltonians over other Hamiltonians. But you can also wonder how many different B0s do I have to study so that I get qualitatively different models. Okay. And it is, again, the type of computation Andrea showed us. It's kind of easy to show that if you have two B0s which lie in the same coadjoint orbit, so if you look at the model for a different B0 that it's related to your starting point B0 by a coadjoint transformation, then this is the same than the model with the starting point B0, except that you have to do a filter definition for your G, which is just a left multiplication by H. So what does it mean? It means you know that at least classically, theories related by filter definitions are equivalent. They are also equivalent in perturbative quantum field theory. So this is called the equivalence theorem. So you don't need to study these different models. So it's enough to study models where you take, if you want to cover the full set of models, it's enough to take one representative per orbit of the partition of the coadjoint representation into coadjoint orbits, if you want. Okay, and then, of course, because we are interested in gravity, we will be interested in the Virasoro group. So a natural question is, what is the classification of your coadjoint representation into coadjoint orbits? And that's not a trivial question, at least not for the Virasoro group. So you have to, the names of the classification of the coadjoint orbits of the Virasoro group I put up here. So Latsutkin and Pankratova. Okay, and then there is Kirillov, of course, in the context of his program. There is the review paper by Witten that Andrea mentioned where he explains all this program for physicists of this classification. And then there's this very nice, understandable discussion in which you can almost understand the complete classification of a set of Hungarian mathematicians, Balogh, Fehr, and all, which go through the full, for the full construction from the point of view of Hill's equation and the SL2R, which sits upstairs. Okay. Now, my small addition to to these actions here. So what should you do to prove that you have all gauge invariances? If you are a physicist, what you would do is, so it's already first order, so it's a bit an overkill to try to do the Hamiltonian formalism, but I found it nevertheless very useful. So what you're doing is you do the same than we did in the proof of Arnold's theorem. You introduce momenta, and you go to the phase space, if you want, and you try to define, you try to invert to do the Hamiltonian analysis, and you immediately realize, because you are first order, that your p's are all constrained. So you cannot invert any of them, but the definition of your p's give rise to primary constraints, all of them. And if you use this better momenta, these coordinates on G star, it turns out that the constraints are just telling you that the pi's should be equal to the fixed B0 that you have put. So that's your primary constraints in your theory. And then you can write down, of course, your Hamiltonian action. So the Hamiltonian action in this non-Darboux coordinates is this object here. The canonical Hamiltonian in this case, you just, on the constrained surface, you are allowed to replace B0 by pi. So that's the Hamiltonian theory that you get. The dynamics is almost the same than we had before. But now you have the explicit dependence on the Lagrange multipliers that you have here, and the pi dot mu's in that case. So with this Hamiltonian, so the Hamiltonian doesn't play a role, but it's just the the Lagrange multipliers that appear. You have a Poisson realization of your neutral charges, which is a good thing. And if you are a physicist, the question that you should ask is, are there secondary constraints? So of course, there are no secondary constraints here. This you can see. So basically, this equation here is the same equation that you have to look at when you are looking at the conservation in time of the constraints. So it turns out that there is no secondary constraints, but all you can get is restrictions on your Lagrange multiplier. So no secondary constraints, but what you still have to do is you have to decide which of your constraints are first class and which are second class, which generate gauge transformation and which don't, if you want. And this equation is very easy to solve now. You write it, so the B0 rho, this coadjoint, infinitesimal coadjoint vector on B0, you write as a matrix, like this. And what you have to find in order to decide which constraints are first and second classes, you have to find a complete set of null vectors of this matrix here. So if you run through the thing, it's interesting then to introduce this complete set of null vectors. You take the complementary set to have a complete basis. And this is the basis that is adopted to the problem. And then, of course, if you like field binds, you write it in the way you know from GR, but it's, of course, a linear algebra problem. So what you're doing. So in this basis, in this adapted basis, then it's completely trivial to see that, that first of all, because this is a subalgebra, if you have two indices which lie in the in the little algebra, you cannot go outside of it, so there is no... These structure constants here are zero, if you have a capital C here. In the same way, because this is the little algebra, once you have a small Latin letter here, these matrices are zero. But at the same time, you know that if you are in the complementary set here, if you only have capital Latin indices, this matrix is invertible. And this contains the proof in this language that you have all gauge symmetries. Okay. And the good thing is, that now you can compute Dirac brackets if you want. You know who are first-class constraints, who are second-class constraints, and you can play the whole game. It's a very nice example of constrained Hamiltonian systems where you can do everything by hand and do just linear algebra. So from that point of view, I hope this makes Simone happy, in fact. So but it's a, so you can take this general algorithm and apply it and make everything in a non-trivial way, I I would say. So you have your first and second class constraints, which are set up like that. And in principle, you can compute Dirac brackets. There is a shortcut to compute Dirac brackets, which is to solve the second class constraints in the action and to invert the so this is no longer a presymplectic potential, but it's symplectic, but to invert the one that you get after having solved only the second class constraints in the action. So you write down the symplectic form after you reduce to the second class constraint. So this is AR here. You compute its exterior derivative. You write down the matrix that it is, and you invert the matrix, and you have the brackets. It's really great to to really compute Dirac brackets explicitly in this case, and well, because one knows how to invert the matrix. Okay, here are the Dirac brackets, and then so this is this thing. So what have we? Suppose you do this in the case of Virasoro. So in the case of Virasoro, what you remain with, after having, if you want, eliminated the second class constraints, was your Euler angles that you had here, and the coadjoint vectors associated to the little algebra. And of course, the Lagrange multipliers associated to that. That's the variables you remain with. Okay? And in a complicated example like Virasoro, this is infinitely-dimensional, but this little algebra, so Andrea didn't have the time to get to the classification of the orbits in that case, but this is finite-dimensional thing. So it's in the typical orbit, it's either U1 or SL2R, if you want. So with a finite number of these pi a's, you have complete control on the system. Okay, very good. That's a nice exercise if you have to teach it. And that's why I like it. Now there's something else that you can do. And this we realized only while trying to apply this now, but it's of course also completely trivial. Suppose you want to do this analysis of the constraints and so on later. So one thing that you can do is just drop all these constraints. So from the very beginning, you work in this bigger, doubled space. So kind of course, if you use both the g's and the pi's as coordinates, you have a huge overcounting in a sense, because every point on the orbit you can either label by the group element that it takes you to go from the representative to the orbit, or by the coadjoint thing. So you have a redundant description, but as we very well know, redundant descriptions are sometimes very useful. So the advantage of this description here, of this model here, is that both the coadjoint vector and the group element are free variables. And I think that's a very, for some developments, it might be actually useful. So then, of course, your equations that you get, you write down again your Hamiltonian equations. The equation, this is just the evolution equation that we have discussed several times. But now it turns out that the pi mu's, which are dynamical variables of your theory, are all dynamically constant, if you want. Okay? So besides your conserved neutral charges that you had in the beginning for the right translations, all the pi's now are also constants of the motion. Okay? And then, of course, if you are a mathematician, this is much too much. So you try to study this, you try to solve these models, and you begin. So all these are constants of the motion. So you would say, let's look at what happens on fixed level sets of this constant of the motion. So B0 becomes a constant. And you would then study Hamiltonian reduction on what happens on these level sets. And you do the whole analysis in reverse. It's exactly the same analysis in reverse. But nevertheless, I like these models a lot, because now you don't have to worry in the first stage about the classification of orbits, and you just write down. So basically, you write down the same models than you had before, but you replace B0 by pi mu, and pi mu is a dynamical variable of your theory. How much time do I have? 30?
20.
Okay, let us move to gravity. So let me maybe take the cleanest gravity model that I know, which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter gravity with Brownian no boundary conditions. So you give your definition of asymptotically ADS three space times, give fall off conditions, and then it turns out that since it's three-dimensional gravity and everything is very easy to compute, you know the general solution to the equations of motion in that case. So the general solution to, so this was found by Max Pagnados, in a sense he has written it down for the first time, the general solution is the following metric, and it contains one arbitrary function of x plus and another arbitrary function of x minus. X plus and x minus here, in this case it's t over l plus minus phi, because that's the the cylinder. You can work out, so this is the general solution to the equations of motion. You can work out how they transform under infinitesimal conformal, so the asymptotic symmetries in this case is two copies of diff S1. Okay, and you can work out how they transform under the infinitesimal transformation, but also you can work out how they transform under the group, if you want. You can do a bit more than you can usually do, because it's... So you find that this arbitrary function of x plus and x minus transforms like the component of an energy momentum tensor in a conformal field theory. And the value of the central charge that is here, so the weight is 2, if you want, so like t plus plus and t minus minus in a CFT. And the classical value that they got from the analysis was a specific value for this central charge, which is sitting. So 3L over 2G. And if you do the group, you find here the Schwarzschild derivative in the transformation of the of the energy momentum tensor. If you do the infinitesimal version, you find the third order derivative, which is the infinitesimal Schwarzschild, if you want. Very good. Maybe let me... So you see that, of course, if you want to really study this example, you have to do two copies of the centrally extended Virasoro group that you have to study from the group theoretical perspective. So you have to go back to your group theory books, for instance, in this Kaysin book, and or in Gueux and Roger on Virasoro, all this is explained. So you have to look at how centrally extended groups work. So you have the standard group, and then you have the additional direction here. You, on the level of the group, you have a group 2 cocycle, which is here. And then when you work out the adjoint representation, so the Lie algebra has an additional element here, usually called Z in the thing. And so the adjoint representation, of course, then have two entries. You have the standard group part, but then you have this part here along the central direction. And this is where the Suryo cocycle comes out, and it's directly related to this group cocycle. On the level of the Lie algebra, of course, the thing that you get is H2 of G into R. So it's a classical Lie algebra problem, which is here. So that's the Lie algebra cocycle. And on the level of the coadjoint representation, the infinitesimal one, this is where you have the infinitesimal Suryo, which is the third order derivative. In that. So you just have to remember all of these things to go to do the construction completely. Okay, and then you write down the geometric action. In principle, it's just an exercise. You put all these pieces together, and you write down this geometric action that I've written before. Either, as we did it before, you write it down for a fixed vector here, or you make this dynamical. But as I've told you, this makes almost, from a point of view of writing things, this makes almost no difference. You just replace B0. Either you interpret B0 and C0 as a dynamical variable, or you take a fixed thing, but it depends in which of the models you are that I've shown. And when you do that, in fact, explicitly for the Virasoro group, so the two cocycle is called the Bott-Thurston two cocycle, and the, you see the actions that you have seen in the gravity literature appear now, which is this Schwarzschild derivative actions here. So this is how they appear. So that's the geometric action for diff hat S1. You write it down explicitly with all possible terms. That's what you're going to find. Okay, and for ADS3 gravity, you have two copies of this story. You have one and the other copy. Then the question is, which Hamiltonian should you choose? And in the case of ADS3 gravity, it's interesting because you have this other construction to arrive at this kind of action. The other construction to arrive at this kind of action is to start from the Chern-Simons formulation, to put your boundary conditions on your spin connection and on your, well, on your AMUs, if you want, in the formulation. And then it turns out that with the boundary conditions that reproduce asymptotically ADS3 gravity, you need the Gibbons-Hawking term. And when you trace this Gibbons-Hawking term, it tells you what is the Hamiltonian you need here in the geometric action. And the Hamiltonian that you find in this geometric action to get the same effective equations of motions than you have here, you have to choose one of the simplest one, which is d over d phi, and which is the one that you have to put in order to reproduce what you had from this three-dimensional perspective, if you want. So this we did in all details for three-dimensional gravity. So I should say that, of course, this was done. So here we have two copies of this story, simply because, as I've tried to show you, the general solution space splits into right and left. But all this, most of it, was already done in the case of lower dimensional gravity theories, like we heard yesterday in the talk by Charles, which was about two-dimensional gravity. Here you have two copies of that. For two-dimensional gravities, these actions were written down a long time ago by Alexeyev and Shatashvili. Look at the titles. They are exactly what we want to talk about in this conference here. So it's quantization of symplectic orbits by means of the functional integral. In this computation, they do the characters of SO3 by using the geometric action, in fact. This is what they compute. So that'd be Andrea's example, I would say, running through that thing. But then they did also so the Virasoro group and 2D gravity, in fact, in that case. And the part that they were writing down was only the one with the central charge, because you can see that this part, you can get it from this part by doing a field redefinition, if you want. That should answer your question. Okay, and then also, of course, there have been more developments on that, but in this late 80s, early 90s, this was a way to generate conformally invariant non-trivial field theories by this kind of group theoretical methods, I would say. Okay, so we had written down this for ADS3 gravity, but then they had been rederived a bit later also from this perspective here, from the Chern-Simons to Vesomino-Witten to Hamiltonian reduction perspective, which was originally done by Kusari and Ovandril, without taking holonomies and more subtle things into account. They just had taken into account what happens at infinity. But if you put holonomies and horizons, you have to do a finer analysis, and this is what Kotler and Jensen did, and then you find exactly the same kind of actions that we also found by this geometric method. So in 3D gravity, what is nice is that you have these two ways of doing this kind of computation, a purely group theoretical and a Chern-Simons reduction kind of construction. If you want to do semi-direct product groups, of course, I mean, the only thing that you have to understand is the adjoint representation and the coadjoint representation. So you have to run through how these things go. For instance, the semi-direct product groups that we have been looking at, which is the Euclidean group, the Poincaré group, BMS3, BMS4, typically have an abelian ideal. But of course, the new groups that people would like to look at here, the ideal is not necessarily, of course, abelian. So you have to see what changes in this picture. But nevertheless, the recipes are the same. You can write these actions. There should be no problem in that. Of course, as usual, the devil is in the detail, and working everything out is work. So Okay, so let me concentrate not on the corner groups, but on the ones which I know a bit better, BMS3, BMS4. So in that case, of course, you have the action of the rotations on the translations, on the, of the super rotations on the translation. You run through all the, the standard arguments. The surprising thing, as I said in many of the talks already, so you have two elements in the coalgebra, if you want, the J's, which is angular momentum, and the P's, which is linear momentum, if you use the terminology from the Euclidean group. And the surprising thing is, of course, that in this case, in the coadjoint representation, it goes the other way, if you want. There's no longer an action of the non-abelian on the abelian part, but it's kind of what you have is the same thing that you have when you study angular momentum. So if you do a translation and you take linear momentum, you produce angular momentum, exactly like in the orbital part of angular momentum. And you just formalize this, and the formalization is that in the coadjoint representation, there's this cross product here, which appears, both on the level of the group and on the level of the algebra, if you want. Okay, and then you have to open up all these things. You write the precisely these actions with a certain Hamiltonian, if you want a Hamiltonian. And what we did a couple of years ago is write this for BMS3, which is a flat space in three dimensions, if you want. You write the geometric actions, and the puzzle is also interesting because you have two central extensions to play with. So you have the coadjoint thing to play with, the semi-direct plus the central extensions, which makes the story a bit richer. And then you write the actions. They are not particularly illuminating, I have to say. I mean, you write them, they look ugly. They have some Schwarzian derivatives in this case. But you know by construction that these are BMS3 invariant 1+1 dimensional field theories. And that's why my question to you, we know that BMS3 is conformal Carroll in these dimensions. So what do they have to do with the things that you were talking about? So they are by construction BMS3 invariant field theories. Okay, the right Hamiltonian in this case is also you get it from the Gibbons-Hawking construction. You see that the Hamiltonian is associated to D over DU if you are looking it up at Sky. And also, we double-checked it in a sense because we also knew how, the first way we got this BMS3 invariant 1+1 dimensional action, and maybe let me say that in this case, of course, the fact that you have a 1+1 dimensional field theory comes from the fact that the inner product that you have here is an integral over the angles, which in your case of the corner groups, if you're doing the inner product between adjoint and coadjoint, will be an integral over the lower dimensional things, hopefully. And that's why even if you write particle actions, you will get field theories, if you want, in a sense. So the field theory aspect is really in the inner product here. And again, in this case, what is nice in this case, as I was trying to say, is that you have this Chan Simons picture. So, in fact, and that's why my question to Gerben is even more, technically maybe precise. We knew at some stage that the dual field theory for this ADS3 gravity is conformal. So one model that you can look at is Liouville theory. Liouville theory is a classical model in 1+1 dimension, which has a classical central extension also. That's interesting. And then what we were looking at, we were phrasing Liouville with the cosmological radius and taking a flat limit after, so L to infinity, which sounds like your C to zero in a sense. And in this way, you get the BMS3 field theory with scalars in the Hamiltonian formulation. So again, my query, what is the relation to? Maybe that's more tractable than the geometric actions because it's the same kind of construction with a limit, I would say. Okay, so that's one way to get this BMS-free field theories. Another one is to take the Chan Simons, chiral Vesumino Witten road, which we also did. So then we were happy because, of course, we were finding the same actions than you get from the geometric, from the just the group theory thing. So let me just, maybe to make it more concrete, run you through the example. So you can do exactly the same thing like in like in the ADS3 case. You say what you mean by asymptotically flat spacetimes at future plus infinity in three dimensions. You give some Folov conditions, which you tune to get what you want. You solve the equations of motion. They can be exactly solved. There's the analog of the Bondi mass aspect, which is here, the Bondi angular momentum aspect, which is here. You know how the BMS symmetries act on your solution space, both the finite and the infinitesimal version. And it so happens that in this case, if you do the gravitational computation, you get the prediction for the central charge exactly in the Brownian way, which is 3 over g if you take Einstein gravity. If you want to turn on this guy, you have to take a gravitational Chern-Simons term to break the parity thing if you want. But so you get the same actions than you get from this group theoretical method. So now the question is, what do you do for BMS4? And one way, one thing to do for BMS4 is to try to repeat the Chern-Simons construction, which is, as far as I understand, is what Jacob tried in some of their papers, to get a Chern-Simons formulation and do a reduction. And the other way is just to write, to control your coadjoint representation of BMS4 well enough and just write the action. That's the other thing that you can do. And then you should, nevertheless, if you want to have a contact with gravity, you should see where in the gravitational phase space you see this coadjoint representation. Okay, this I have showed many times. So how much time do I have left? 5 minutes. Okay, I will not do the coadjoint representation of BMS4, and it's an exercise to do it. So what you have to realize is that it looks nice on the celestial sphere. If you write a celestial sphere as a conformally flat sphere, because then you have this picture where you can work either with conformal fields or with scalars. And this is very well known how to go from tensors to scalars. You just use your field binds to tensor all your indices into into scalars, if you want. And then you have this interpolation map, so between things which have spin and boost labels related to the SO3 1 of the Lorentz group, or you work with the conformal field theory people with the conformal dimensions h and h bar, if you want. Okay, and then you have the covariant derivative on the sphere, the ingredients that go into the coadjoint representations is you have to give the right fields here. It turns out that in terms of conformal fields, the supertranslations is -1/2, -1/2. The globally well-defined, the Lorentz rotations, the Lorentz group appears most transparently in this way on the celestial sphere as the conformal killing vectors of the of the celestial sphere. So you have a chirality conditions on this object, and then if you write down the, because these are not free fields, if you want, if you write down the object in the dual space, you have to take equivalence classes. You cannot just you have this chiral condition, you have to take equivalence classes of these objects up to d of something, if you want, because otherwise you do not have a non-degenerate inner product. Okay, let me not run you through that, but then you work out the coadjoint representation. It took us some work, nevertheless, to get it done. So the most intriguing one, where people were not maybe convinced for other reasons, was that the linear Bondi momentum should have conformal dimensions 3/2, 3/2, but I think by now this is settled. But this is what the group theory gives you. And then you have this wedge product here, which is what goes into the coadjoint representation, and you can work out everything. And in fact, I find it nevertheless sometimes surprising that the adjoint representation of the group is just, so it sounds very abstract, but it's just these transformation laws for the fields. it's this transformation loss for the Ys, these transformations for the super rotations. And the coadjoint representation is telling you that it is this transformation loss of the fields which is the coadjoint representation, or in terms of conformal fields, this kind of object. Okay, you can expand everything in terms of spherical harmonics if you really want. There is a subtlety. So everything depends if you want to do extended BMS or standard BMS with everything globally well-defined on the sphere. There is a subtlety which tells you that this conformal killing equation on the sphere has the same solution than the infinitesimal Schwarzian derivative here, which is something I didn't know, which you can read off here, and which played an important role for us to identify it in the solution space, I should say. So on the sphere, these two things have the same solutions. Something you have to know. We didn't, and that's why we were computing for months and not getting what we wanted, I have to say. Of course, you can do, I like, of course, the extended BMS with super rotations, which are where formulas become much more conformal field theory-like. But the construction is very much the same, except that you release, it's then no longer true that the chiral condition and the third order conditions are the same. You only have the chiral condition effect. Okay. So where can you see that in the gravitational phase space? So in the gravitational phase space, of course, you can do your, we heard it in several talks, so I will not talk about it here. You have your BMS charges. If you have news and outgoing radiation, they are not conserved. There is Bondi mass loss, and you have the thing. So this geometric action is only a theory for the conserved stuff. So the only thing you can expect is to find it if you turn off the news, if you want to find it on the nose. So if you turn off the news, you look at asymptotically flat non-radiative spacetimes where you just say that the asymptotic part of the shear does not depend on you. So you turn it off. You find at the same time in the solution space psi 03, psi 04 is zero. These breakings are all zero. And you compare what you see in your data with the transformation loss that you see, that you know that the coadjoint representation has. If you do that, you find, of course, that the linear momentum is just the Bondi mass aspect, psi 02 plus psi bar 02. But more complicated is the angular momentum aspect. And the thing that you get from your computation of the charges, so this is what should be the angular momentum aspect. And then you have to check if it transforms in the right way, if you have turned off the news, in order to know that it's the coadjoint representation. That's the computation that you have to do. So you want to check that if you have what I would call a pre-momentum map, so you know that the space of radiative free data that you have in your asymptotically flat solution space carries a representation of BMS4 on the infinitesimal level, and you would like to see which combination is exactly transforming in the coadjoint. So that's the problem, and if you work it out, so of course there's absolutely no problem to find the Bondi mass, but this object here has a complicated transformation law. You recognize very quickly the first terms that you need, and then you have a lot of junk. And a lot of junk, of course you knew that if the junk is at bar of something, you are happy, because this is what you project out in these equivalence classes, so you consider it zero. But there was also lots of terms which combined precisely to be this D3 of something. But since these are the same dual spaces, this is the coadjoint representation. Sometimes people have taken a simplified momentum map because you can see that psi 01 would do the job if you were in the electric case. But you don't need to do that. The thing that comes out, it's enough to turn off the news and to use really this object here. It would be nice to find situations where the electric, well, non-electric situations where this more complicated thing plays a role. Say again? No, we don't need to impose it at all. You don't need to, but the computation is much longer to identify the coadjoint. And the problem is that you have to realize that what is not transforming as it should is trivial because it's either this, these quotients here are the same quotients. If you fold it with a killing vector, it gives zero. So that's what, and that's why these things about equivalence classes is important. So you don't need to impose it, and you shouldn't impose it, at least not if you believe the theory of charges that you have constructed. I'm done.
Sorry, Glenn.
Oh.
Just to make the statement clear on the previous slide.
Okay.
So is the statement that in the general case, not just the electric case, but the general case, then the one that transforms well is not psi 1, but it's the...
It's a corrected psi 1, yes. It's a psi 1 with these decorations.
But that's Dreyer-Schreiber, right?
Probably.
Right. Okay. So why do people then insist, like Strominger and Joffrey insist on using only psi 1, do you know?
Well, because I don't know if they insist, but maybe, okay, it depends what you want to do.
At least you clarify that in the electric case, there's no difference.
I wouldn't say there's no difference. Ah. Both are the co-adjoint
both
representation.
Are the co-adjoint. Okay.
I would say that.
Danke.
I think that question has been resolved by Miguel and Alok in a kind of a complicated paper. But essentially, what you want to show is also that your charge is a quotient by this d square. You know, it's an equivalence
Absolutely.
Class.
Absolutely.
And the guy that, so what you can show is that the physical charge, which is the psi 1, is in the same equivalence class as, so you're working with BMS here.
Yeah. But no, I'm not. I don't think it's in the same equivalence class. I mean, what
up to corner terms. That's what Miguel and
okay. This we should check. But okay. But this electric condition is a differential condition. I mean, it's
yeah.
Okay. Also Miguel and sometimes they are in a bit larger thing because they are diff S2.
Exactly.
And then you
have
to check. I mean, and then it's not exactly this problem. You have to go over it again and see how it goes.
No, that's it. They construct the charges for the more larger group, and there it fixes that ambiguity.
True, but
this
but
is also maybe what Laura and Romain are using is that, in some sense, this dressing is
for
is
sure
that the Hersteka-Strobel class is only valid for the restrictive BMS.
For sure, but this is the diff S2. You know, in the diff S2, you do not have the chiral condition either. You do not have the chiral condition on the thing, and you do not have the equivalence classes. Mm-hmm. So, as we discussed, it's a much nicer setup with much less constraints, if you want, but it's not the classical setup, and at least, okay. And, well, I would like to run through it, but because I'm still puzzled by the fact that there should be no mass loss and these things. Okay, it's very interesting questions. I can tell you what I know in the standard case, and not...
It's much harder to understand the symplectic structure. That's much, much harder.
Yeah.
And we should really wrap up.
Wrap up, okay. Let me show you the geometric action for BMS4. You just write it down, and you look what it gives. We have to fix all signs and conventions. Something that I like in this extended model is that you can write the KKS Poisson brackets for the co-adjoint vectors. And if you write them down, so I have not checked this yet with all signs, but you get on the level of Poisson brackets the same kind of formulas that we saw in Laura's talk on the level of operator product expansions. And I hope it's going to match as it should, because this should be the classical version of what you have, but this needs to be checked. But in these models where the pi's are also canonical variables, you can do that, and then you have to check, you have to work. So this is for extended BMS. You have to see where the deltas go and how they transform. That's something we absolutely should do. Okay, let me finish. So maybe what we should do is apply this to corner symmetry groups, some of it that could be useful. But let me stop there.
Thank you very much, Glenn.